Never talk yourself out of doing an experiment.
Oh, the humanity! Get away from the smoking wreckage! And listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies that no one else wants to talk about. And odds are for at least as long as it takes to watch the movies. This is episode 161, and my name is Randy.
And my name is Jakob.
Okay. All right, I want to thank everyone out there, all of our listeners, for joining us. It's great to have you, as always. Last week, if you were here with us, you heard us ramble about 1970s airport sequels. That's Airport 75, Airport 77, and Concorde Airport 79.
The originality and the titling convention is staggering. Oh, my God.
Isn't
oh,
it?
God. Oh, God.
Yeah, so it's a comprehensive episode, not just of airport terror, but also the disaster genre, I want to say. But at any rate, yeah, that's our theme this month, 1970s air terror. We talked also about 1972's Skyjacked a couple weeks ago, so fun discussions all. We're concluding the theme today with today's chat, but first, our announcements on our Patreon, www.patreon.com/uncutgemspod. In our tie-in episode connecting to the February theme, we discussed the original airport film from 1970, and arguably it was the kickoff to the whole disaster subgenre. Also, this month we've begun our Spike Lee Talking Joints series on Patreon. We're going to be discussing his better known films, so his major joints, and we talked about School Days. The great Jack Luke Sharp was with us for that wonderful conversation. And next week, watch for it, on February 28th, we'll be releasing the second episode in our Catherine Bigelow marathon. We'll be talking about Near Dark. So, yeah, and for this project, this 2024 project, we will be talking about all of her films. So last month, not all that long ago, if you want, you can go check out our first episode in that series where we talked about Catherine Bigelow's The Loveless, her debut film, and also Willem Dafoe's debut film. So that's there for your enjoyment. But it's not just these three episodes. Never is. Three is the magic number that we commit to each month. You can go check out our Patreon and you'll find 81, 82, something like that, episodes on our Patreon for you to listen to for your enjoyment. In 2023, we completed our comprehensive John Cassavetes marathon. That's there. In 2022, we completed a David Lynch marathon. So all of those men's films are discussed on our Patreon. We also have our Soderbergh series. The Shallow Cuts are all there. His better known films from our 2023 Soderbergh project. That's on our Patreon. So lots of good conversation, which is available for just $3 a month or $4.50 Canadian. So again, that's at patreon.com/uncutgemspod. But if you're not up for an ongoing financial commitment, no problem. If you would like to send us a one-time contribution, we would be ever so grateful. It helps pay the bills. You can do so at ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod. That's ko-fi.com. But at the same time, no obligation. There are some free episodes on our Patreon. If you track them down, you can give them a listen if you're so inclined. The Thing, Cabaret, The Exorcist, Heat. There's some good ones there. Try those out. Or you know what? Just tell your friends. If you have movie-loving friends, tell them about what we do. Tell them about our main show. Tell them about our Patreon. And if you were to do that, we'd be ever so grateful. So if you are out there and you're a supporter, I just want to take a quick moment to thank you for what you do. Your support means an awful lot to us. Thank you. It validates what we do. So Jakob and I say that we do this for ourselves, but for some reason, there are folks out there who believe in us and they give us their hard-earned cash. So to you, we're doing it for you as well. And thank you, thank you, thank you for that. Okay. Today's itinerary, we're concluding our February theme. So it's our final Terror in the Skies voyage. And we're going to climb aboard. we're going to talk about the 1975 historical disaster film starring George C. Scott, chronicling the fateful east-to-west transatlantic flight of the Hindenburg.
Brad. Showing us how you do it in Spain?
Well, I'm afraid I don't fly very much there.
It's good to have you back, Franz. We hear they're giving you a knight's cross to your Iron Cross.
We're writing up dossiers, I suppose. Half the time on our own people. It's turning us into a Gestapo, Aaron. Get me out of intelligence. Give me back my old reconnaissance command.
That might not be easy, Franz.
Why not? All you have to do is sign the orders.
You've been brought back for a special problem, which we've inherited.
We've had our suspicions, Colonel. And now that letter confirms there is a plot to sabotage the LZ-129 on this flight.
Obviously, Dr. Goebbels, the sane thing to do is to cancel the flight until the Gestapo uncovers the plot.
Sane, but weak. The propaganda value of the LZ-129 is highly important.
From a military standpoint, she's a flying dinosaur.
Okay, the Hindenburg 1975 film, directed and produced by Robert Wise, written by Nelson Gidding. So he's a regular Wise writer. We talked about him when we did our episode on the Andromeda Strain. Go check that
Nelson
out.
Getting fired. Sorry. I've
been waiting for that, have you?
I just jumped to the shark in here. Sorry. Jumped to the gun.
Also written by, so two other screenwriters, we'll be talking about them a bit, I believe, Richard Levinson and William Link. Film stars George C. Scott and Bancroft. William Atherton from Ghostbusters. Did you recognize him?
Yeah, I did. Also from Die Hard, right?
Right, yes. It's Dickless himself. So he's in here. Charles Durning is in here. Very important. Yeah, this is a big role. Burgess Meredith is in here. This is a year before Rocky, I want to say. Yeah. Rene Auberjonois is in here.
He didn't say anything in the Mickey sound.
He's in like, the voice.
In no, the voice. He was like, get him some shorts. It's very tight. He wasn't speaking like that at all.
He's very just normal talking. We got Richard Dysart in here from The Thing.
He lightning and crap thunder. It's just like, what?
All right. So The Hindenburg is a 1975 historical thriller directed by Robert Wise. Depicting
Why
the infamous...
is he doing this to me?
we'll the get puns. There. We'll the get puns. There. Okay. Start that again. Okay. So this is from ChatGPT. I followed your lead. So ChatGPT is now the official provider of our plot synopses. The Hindenburg is a 1975 historical thriller directed by Robert Wise, depicting the infamous disaster of the German airship LZ-129. Hindenburg in 1937. The film follows Colonel Franz Ritter, that's Scott, a security officer assigned to investigate potential sabotage threats against the Zeppelin, as the luxurious airship embarks on its transatlantic journey from Germany to the United States. Ritter has to unravel a mystery. Is there a bomb? Is there not a bomb? If there is a bomb, where is the bomb and who planted it? Because what is for sure, and this is my contribution, just like Oppenheimer, you watch this film, you can bet there's going to be at least one explosion.
And boy, is there.
Yeah, there is. We'll get to it. So in terms of behind the scenes on this, interest in the film began as a result of the success in disaster films in the early 70s, which we've been talking about all month. Three script writers, Nelson Gidding, so as I mentioned, he was a regular Robert Wise collaborator. And these other two guys, William Link and Richard Levinson. Now, I wasn't too familiar with these guys, but I looked them up. They're a screenwriting and production team. They became friends like in middle school because they were both amateur magicians. So they began writing. And a lot of their work is inspired by Agatha Christie. So you get a lot of solving mysteries in their work. These two guys created Columbo in 1968, and they created Murder, She Wrote in 1984. Mm-hmm. So their script, it seems, caught the eye of Gidding as a potential project to work on himself and also with Wise. So when Wise became interested, he went off to do about a year of research, I want to say. So he was going extensively through Hindenburg documents in the UK, the US, and Germany. He was interested in a disaster film, which was a popular genre at the time, but he wanted to bring an air of authenticity to this film. So that
Boy,
began,
did he.
Yes, he did. That began with the script because even though we're dealing with a lot of fiction in here, most of the characters are modeled off of actual passengers of the Hindenburg on the fateful trip. The production built massive
Some dramatic
models.
License, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. So there were massive airship models that were built. There's a full-scale set of the nose of the Hindenburg that was used for the destruction scene. The sets of the interior of this ship were recreated as accurately as possible. So they had massive art departments and special effects departments. I forget the studio here, but whatever studio it was, they were using the biggest soundstage on the lot. Wise planned to use actual newsreel footage of the Hindenburg disaster for the climax. So he planned to shoot the whole thing in black and white originally in order to match it up nicely with the newsreel and also to establish the era and give it sort of an artsy look. But the studio said, absolutely not, Robert. You may not do that. So what Wise did, you cannot do that. This is the color age of cinema. But Wise did end up using the newsreel footage at the end, and the final, whatever it is, 10 minutes or so, is filmed in black and white. And we'll talk about that. Footnote, when they were shooting...
I have a note on this.
When they were shooting, this is just a couple little trivia bits that I have. When they were shooting the scene with the full-scale nose set, there were crew members and stuntmen that were sort of in the rigging, and they were going to set it on fire, you know, just once and then film it from different angles. So when they did this, the fire quickly got out of control and stuntmen and technicians were totally overwhelmed by the smoke. There were no injuries, but several of the cameras that were set up, they were damaged and the entire soundstage nearly caught on fire. So there was very little footage to actually come out of that day's work. But there's 4 seconds of the footage in the film, and I meant to go back and try to determine where it was, but at any rate, that was one little trivia little bit. And another little trivia bit here is, and I got this from Wikipedia, the acrobat in this is based on an actual Hindenburg passenger who was a successful performer. And according to Wikipedia, I just wanted to mention this because I thought it was interesting. According to Wikipedia, this performer, I forget his name, he went by the stage name Ben Dova. That was the artist's, you know, stage name. But
we
anyway,
need to get a medic in here.
According to Wikipedia, Ben Dova escaped the Hindenburg using his acrobat skills. So I just thought that was hilarious. So I wanted to read.
Do you think
it.
He did like a somersault on his way down?
I don't know. Was he sort of jumping and hopping through the, you know, the rigging and the lattice work of the ship and until he could find an opening to jump to safety? I have no idea what that means, but it amused me a little. So there's that. The Hindenburg had a $15 million budget. It was released on Christmas Day in 1975, and at the box office, it did okay. It earned $28 million. It was the 14th biggest film of the year, but it wasn't a breakout hit. It was just suitable, we'll say. It was just an okay disaster film.
Suitable.
But critics really didn't groove with it. Ebert didn't like it. Most of the main critics didn't like it. Ebert gave it a 1-star review, which started with, it's a disaster picture, all right. Vincent Canby called it brainless and pricelessly funny at the wrong moments. But despite this, he said there's some fun in there and technical accomplishments. Siskel thought it was dumb, but he really enjoyed the effects. Pauline Kael went after Robert Wise himself. So I don't know if there's a history there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, this was her quote, one gas bag meets another. So so that seems more personal.
I need a Limp Bizkit for this. Someone just had a
guns
axe to grind.
Guns were blazing. So I don't know. It seems to me there must be a Robert Wise history there with Pauline Kael. Anyway, in today's metrics, will say Rotten Tomatoes holds it at only 33% fresh, so it hasn't really stood the test of time, I want to say, even though if you look at Letterboxd, its users give it a not too bad aggregate score of 3 out of 5. But now that brings us
cowards
yeah that brings us to it. So Jakob, What did you think of the Hindenburg?
Oh, was it's amazing. It's what? Fantastic.
Good,
no, it's not.
I want to hear all about it.
No, it is not. Look. I watched this and I imagined that watching this film is kind of similar to actually taking a trip in a Zeppelin. As in like, wow, this is awful fucking slow. And just, well, it took days for this thing to go to America. Days. Days, I tell you. This is how long it feels this movie lasts. Days. Almost, I feel like this maybe Robert Wise was like a maverick for his time, I think. He was kind of like, well, let's just like put emphasis on realism, you know? If you know what I mean. Like when we were talking about the Andromeda strain. Andromeda. Fuck me, what am I doing? Andromeda strain. Like we were talking all about how this feels like it's putting so much effort into making sure that you feel this is like a document of some description. And I'm thinking maybe he's doing it here in that he's staging an Agatha Christie murder on the Orient Express, or as I called it in my notes, murder on the Sparky Balloon. But the gimmick is that he's going to make it feel like it lasts exactly as long as it probably took for this thing to travel to America, only to just gloriously go down in flames on approach. Right? Just to spite you. But and also my note says like, wow, this explosion at the end, like it knocks the color out of the picture. The bomb was so powerful it knocked the color out. It's like the reverse Wizard of Oz.
Right off the screen.
Like, you know, Dorothy gets hit over the head and I was like, ta-da, Technicolor. And meanwhile, George C. Scott just fails to defuse a bomb. It's just like, no, no color for you, hombre. But I'm getting ahead of myself. This movie's boring. I have no idea what's happening in it. And actually, maybe I do have an idea, but I don't care. This movie is so protracted, languid, boring, and useless that I don't quite like. You know what? I agree with Roger. Sometimes I disagree with him. And I have a crusade to launch. Just if I have to go after someone's memory, it will be Pauline Kael. but she's right. Like, this movie is bad. But I appreciate seeing George C. Scott when he's kind of still sort of in shape. Because this was like, this is my note, like, you know, like, good to see George C. Scott in shape. That's my note, actually. As I'm watching this, it's like, because I take my notes, and my notes are kind of like a stream of consciousness out of which I then pick my tops and bottoms.
Oh, my. I'm just trying to see how old George C. Scott was at this time. Because I still think he looks like an old man.
Let me tell you, let me guess, 43. Tell me it was 43.
No, he's 47 when this comes out.
Wow.
Like to me, the guy has always looked 60 or older.
It must be the whiskey.
He looks the
binge drinking.
Like, he looks a little leaner, and I think I think he has one of those faces that he just looks a little older anyway. But at the same time, as someone who recently turned 50, I like to think I look younger than this guy and that he looks old.
This is just the alcohol dependency or something like this.
Maybe
like
that's
some in certain cultures, like if you look at like middle-aged Russian men who are like in their 40s and they do look 60, like they have like life carved into their faces. And that's just alcohol.
As it turns out, it wasn't a rough life.
You know, it's like it's the tough life, you know, like living a life of, you know, like hard labor when after a long day in the mines, you come back home, you pour yourself a nice tall glass of vodka and just take off your belt and just beat your kids because they're loud or something. Right? That's kind of...
That's kind of the 60 that he looks in this. But he is leaner.
He looks like a disappointed dad who's just inch away from domestic violence.
And this is a guy we like. Okay.
Like, he's the kind of guy who just, like, you know, to turn it off. He's just, and he's not talking about the porno he sees with his kid in it. No, it's the cartoons that the kids are playing in their own room on their little TV because it pisses him off, and they turn it off immediately because they know the belt's going to come off right this second.
They're having fun at a time of day when no one should.
Exactly. In my day, we didn't have fun. We walked to and from school uphill, okay? In the snow with a boner.
I've never heard that variation, thanks. All right. Okay, so that's your opening impression. Yeah, yeah. So there's room for improvement, you're saying?
Yes, there's that's some exactly what I'm saying.
To get better, okay?
The charitable interpretation of what I'm just saying is that there's room for improvement. This movie could be better, but you know what? I'm looking forward to this. Or I could just go full on Jack Luke Chap and say, like, I don't look forward to this one bit. I don't know what I'm doing. This movie is bad, and I don't think what's going to happen over the course of the next 450 minutes that it's going to take to unfold this disaster.
Well, let's see if my first impressions can begin to change your mind, bring you up a little bit. For me, I saw this a year or so ago, actually, as part of my homework or adjacent work to the Andromeda Strain. So, oh, this is cool. And I also watched The Haunting. But I did not go back and watch Robert Wise's musicals. And I think I also watched Audrey Rose. There'd be an interesting case to watch that and do that on the show too sometime.
If you ask me ever to watch West Side Story, I'm gonna kill myself in protest. I'm gonna just like go out to my front to the car park, and I'm gonna light myself on fire.
Or if you light a jungle gym on fire and pretend you're the acrobat trying to get out, as the guy does at the end of this movie, that could be fun.
Or that,
alternatively.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway.
Cut this out because this is potential culpability here.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, so yeah, so I did see this last year around the time I was watching Andromeda Strain for the show, and I checked out The Haunting, and I really like Robert Wise. I think that he's got a great visual style. You said it, he's a maverick. He's a very fun visual director. I really like that. I really like that about the Hindenburg. I think that it has a strong visual look. But you know what? It's boring. It's everything you said, and I can't escape it. Like, I like watching George C. Scott here a little bit because it's George C. Scott, and he's got this sort of swagger and presence, but he's not really doing anything. And then he's sort of conducting an investigation. I was like, okay, I can get into this a little bit, and I'm learning about these different narratives because I feel like we talked about this all in January as well with Nonstop and The Commuter. You know, just take this mass transit vehicle.
This is not Nonstop. This is Please Stop.
This is slowly moving. Yeah, but you know, this whole idea of a mystery contained within a vehicle, and you know, find a bomb or find the bomber. So I'm recognizing this stuff from our Liam Neeson conversations. And then I do the research on Link and Levinson. It's like, oh, these guys love this stuff because, you know, they love, you know, the trickery of magic because they were into sleight of hand stuff. That's how they met. But then a lot of their TV
it's like
work.
Terror Train.
It's sort of. Exactly. I was thinking that because the producer loved magic. But also like the Agatha Christie and the... Specifically, the Murder, She Wrote and the Columbo. That's exactly what they're writing here. They're writing a mystery because you need something to do on this voyage. You need something for a narrative to take us from the start to the end.
George C. Scott. George C. Scott, the C stands for Columbo.
Yeah. But you know what? It is a really, really, really dull ride. So, I'm not going to be the one to defend this. But again, as we're talking about these air terror and just sort of the greater subgenre, genre of disaster films, especially in the 70s, it's sort of interesting. to maybe have a chat about this film, because I would say the production value is upped quite a bit from the first two airport movies. And like I said, I sort of like the look of this. I can get behind, you know, what Cisco was saying, that, you know, there's some merit here to the technical categories and stuff. But yeah, like this is a very dull ride, but I'm interested in getting into this, not just because of, you know, Robert Wise, but also, you know, talking about, you know, the industry and disaster films. But why do you think, I'll start here, why do you think this turned audiences off at the time? Audiences were sort of okay with it, but critics in particular, they didn't like it. It didn't make as much money. Oh, I had a note here. 1974. Where are my notes?
Well, Towering Inferno made like $200 million.
Yeah, right? I've got it here.
Because that was 1975, I want to say, right?
So this is 75. Said? Towering Inferno. Just a sec. I got it. Where are you? 74.
Christmas.
Yeah, just hold on. It's 74, but... Okay. Yeah, 74. Top, the second film of the year, Towering Inferno. Fifth highest grossing film of the year, Earthquake. Seventh highest grossing film of the year, Airport, 1975. So, Airport 1975, which was a 1974 release. Then, in 1975, the Hindenburg is like the only one that I could find in the whole top list, top 50 list of films. It's the only disaster film in there. So what's the turnoff? Why do you think that the critics didn't like this?
The simple answer is because it's not as good, right? If I were to humor this, right? Like, let's dig into this. Let's psychoanalyze this thing. Like, why doesn't it work? So I think... this is not necessarily a disaster film, right? To me, this is almost, well, it's a bit of a weird thing. If I were to, maybe this is kind of just like encroaching on some kind of a different talking point, but it feels like, you know, this is the kind of movie like Peter Berg would make with Patriot's Day or... like United 93, like where this, where you're trying to it's a weird docudrama where you take a little bit of fact and you fill in the gaps with something that you feel it maybe will make it a bit more interesting because you don't know all the facts, so you just have to make shit up a little bit. And okay. Is Murder on the Orient Express 1976?
I'll check. '74.
Okay, so yeah, so I suppose like this whole thing was kind of in vogue. Right, so what I'm thinking is,
and it was number 10 highest grossing.
So it was big. As I suppose Columbo was big at the time, wasn't it? And also there's just all the... What's his face that Cassavetes was in? Jesus.
Oh, yeah. What was that show?
We talked about this for a year now, and I'm just like, what's going on? Like, I'm blanking so hard on these names. This is not good.
Continue your thought.
But yeah, what I'm saying is that if you just agree to look past the simple fact that maybe the story is just not as exciting, there's also the problem with that you're waiting for stuff to happen, right? So it's essentially it's Titanic of its time. So it's not a disaster film because you're waiting for this, you're watching this to kind of just, okay, well, let's... Johnny Staccato, thank you. But you're watching, the whole gimmick of this movie is to pad out the runtime with something interesting until the money shot happens, where everyone came here to see the burning Zeppelin. Kind of like everyone came to watch the Night to Remember or the Titanic from 1997 to watch the ship go down, right? And I suppose you win or lose on two fronts, either on, like, if I suppose, okay, well, you have to have the two right, as in, like, you can't just totally balls up the run-up, because by the time when it goes, like, oh, finally, we're 2 hours in and this is happening and now we can go home, like, the audience is pissed and you're not recoverable. So you have to... Like, you have to fill it with something. So they put this Agatha Christie sort of Hercule Poirot type mystery on the Zeppelin based on hearsay and good intentions, right? Because I think there are some, like, well, conspiracy theories that maybe this was sabotage, maybe it was them, and it's just like, I don't know, maybe just someone smoked a cigarette when they weren't supposed to, because this whole thing was filled with hydrogen and I don't think they read the label, you know? Or maybe they did, because German science was quite strong and they just, it was just the 30s, they didn't have helium, because it was, let's just say, helium is difficult to get. And America is the biggest producer of helium on the planet, if you don't know.
I do now, because they make a point of it in this movie.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Yeah. And also, there's a fun little fact. America has the biggest storage of helium, and helium is an element that actively escapes the planet, if you don't know. It is mined, mostly. It's mined from gas deposits. So it will be small amounts of it will be in natural gas deposits, right? So you kind of just distill it off of there and then just keep it. As in, you cool it down and you distill it off at like minus 200 something degrees, right? Because, America has like the massive storages of it. The problem is, and this is why we're in a massive race against time. Apologies for a tangent. Because if you ever go to a hospital and you want to get an MRI, this is something that this is possible thanks to the wonderful physical phenomenon of superconductivity, which is a quality of certain materials to superconduct, to become magnetic at very, very low temperatures. And which is achieved with liquid helium. So if you go into a hospital, hospitals use liquid helium like motherfuckers. And all academic institutions use liquid helium like motherfuckers for their NMR instruments to analyze chemical structures, right? Problem is that helium, if it escapes to the atmosphere, it will slowly evaporate from the planet. It will just leave into space. Because it's small enough that it will do so. So we don't really recycle it. It's very difficult to recycle it. And the one that you do, like, you always have losses. So eventually, we will run out of usable helium. And that's going to be a problem for many, many people. But anyway, coming back to this, I think the biggest problem of that is you're making a gamble, and apologies for ranting, you know?
I'm learning about chemistry. Keep going.
Yeah.
But you're back anyway.
Biggest problem with this film is that you're staying... Okay, well, there's this big 5-minute sequence that we're banking on. This is it. This is the money shot in here. This is what we're getting these people into seats so that they can watch this. And then we have to contextualize with something so they care about seeing this for some reason. Problem is, they make us root for Nazis.
Yeah, and actually, you're hitting a number of my talking points. So... it's all in here. Well, the helium is one I said, well, that's sort of interesting that they would even raise that. But now I got even more informed on the realities of the helium market. But yeah, in terms of why I think that what I'm going to add to the side of the discussion that has to do with why did people... seemingly not like this. Yes, I think you're onto something. I wonder too if the life cycle of the disaster film is actually very, very short, because there was this huge hit that started it off with Airport. And then there's, like I said, in 1974, three of the top seven films were disaster films. But then from here, they all start fizzling. Nothing Hans really Roger starts Coleman to register.
Gets on the bandwagon. This is it.
Yeah. So yeah, like, I actually had, did the Hindenburg kill the disaster movie? Because where is it here?
What's in 1976?
1976, none in the top 10.
77?
Airport is number 18. 1978, you've got the Bermuda Triangle. That was 33.
Yeah, what is the Swarm?
That's 79 or something, but I think it's pretty far down. Meteor in 1979 is number 46 at the box office. Concorde Airport 79 is number 41. But see, after 1975, I think that New Hollywood has really taken over the box office, where you've got your Rockies, you got your Rockies and Star Wars, and then there's sort of no turning back. And even your Rocky Twos, people are more interested in Jaws 2 than they are in another disaster film, you know, by the time you get to the end of the 90s. So it's not necessarily that the disaster film sort of fizzled out on its own, maybe in part because there was nothing really strong in 1975. But I think once you get to 76, people have moved on to, you know, the feel-good stuff of Rocky and, you know, definitely Star Wars and Jaws. Jaws is in there too, making an impact.
It starts with The Godfather. Like, if you think about, like, what you're seeing in the box office, I think, is a reflection of what happened before. So if you look at 1974 in film, and you're right, The Towering Inferno, and then Earthquake number 4, and Airport 75 number 7. The three, right? All told, they blow everything out of the water, right? Now, in between the lines, as you read this, The Godfather Part 2 gets released Christmas 1974, right?
Yeah.
And then also, The Towering Inferno, also Christmas. Yeah, December 20th. And it also earns like between, I don't know, almost like $100 million, right? So I think it starts already in 1974. We kind of reach the apex, as in like, well, and then we reach the apex because between 1970 and 1972, when you have your Poseidon Adventure and all that, people start saying like, this is it. Like, we're actually making a killing here. So after Airport hits it big, they all greenlight all sorts of crap. And it actually all comes to a head in 1974 where people say, look, it's great. But at the same time, we have all this shit coming out. And in 1975, you have what? Top 10. Jaws, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Horror Picture Show, Shampoo, Dog Day Afternoon, The Return of the Pink Panther.
It's pretty much all New Hollywood.
The right? 3 Days Except of the Condor, New Hollywood. Dog Day Afternoon, Shampoo, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Jaws. Right? Yeah. New Hollywood. 76. What's that in television? What am I doing? Hold on.
Here it is. That too.
Rocky, A Star Is Born, King Kong, Silver Streak, All the President's Men, The Omen, The Bad News Bears, The Enforcer, In Search of Noah's Ark, and Midway. A bit more mixed, but still New
Taxi
Hollywood.
Driver's in the top 15, Marathon Man, but it's Carrie's in the top 20.
And in 1977, everything gets upended because Star Wars just takes the cake.
That's right.
Right? And you still have Saturday Night Fever, Smokey and the Bandit, Close Encounters, The Deep. The Deep was number 7.
But you know what? Even these films.
<any hole. laughs> But yeah.
But this is a transition time from the way the studios were doing business. So this, like, I really find this month of conversations, even though the films haven't been good. It's fascinating to really study sort of
some were good.
Well, yeah, we'll get to them. but it's really interesting to see sort of this transition. And because we've talked forever about New Hollywood taking over, but I think on the business side, we're seeing it happen here. And I sort of see the disaster films as the old studio guard, the traditional studio films. This is their last kick at the can. This is the last thing that we're going to do it the old way.
To me, Hindenburg is like a death rattle.
Well, yeah, like I say, did the Hindenburg kill the disaster movie? Did it kill studio filmmaking? Where sort of like, and it's right around this time. I'm not going to sort of blame the Hindenburg.
Fox had Star Wars, right? It was still a studio film.
No, but. But what's happening, what I mean is they're transitioning their business model, their operations model. They're getting away from, we've got a stable of writers out here ready to go. And that becomes more of a TV thing, I want to say, for years to come and sitcoms. Because now the studios are more interested in the Robert Evans guy. And I don't really know his story. But Robert Evans, the producer for Paramount, he would have been out and shopping Polanski and shopping with, I don't know if he did anything with Scorsese, but certainly The Godfathers. He's dialed into what the youngsters want. He's dialed into this new wave of filmmakers that's coming out of California in the West and New York in the East. He's dialed into what folks are wanting to see, the young folks, this stuff from Schlesinger and the boys from USC like Coppola and Milius and these types of guys, because these young guys are starting to make films and make impressions on an audience. So I think that there are fewer and fewer films like the Hindenburg after 1975. And just in looking at the box office in the first half of the decade, it's like you say, okay, well, sort of the peak of the disaster film is 1974 with those three big ones in the top seven.
And some of them, like, it kind of dribbles into 1975, because some of these will be like Christmas releases, like The Towering Inferno, just like, it's 1974 box office, but it's collected in 1975.
Sure, yeah. So anyway, I find this sort of conversation interesting. And I think the fact that the Hindenburg isn't that great, and it is slow and it's got the exact problems that you mentioned, it's not doing the genre any favor and any favors. And I would liken this to a disaster film more than, because I don't think there's such a thing as a historical fiction disaster thing. Like have you seen, A Night to Remember?
Oh, no, I don't think I have.
No, I haven't. I'm really curious about it.
I've seen excerpts from it. Mm-hmm. But no, I haven't seen it in entirety.
No, and I haven't either.
But it's from like the 50s.
Yeah. But it's the only thing I can think of beforehand that might be close to this, that's not like a war film.
Isn't like this is historical fiction.
Historical fiction.
Yeah. I don't think I could... think of a different example either.
Right. Because it becomes a bit of a thing with, the Pearl Harbors and the Titanics and whatever. Like
there's Tora, Tora, Tora. There's Midway, I suppose. But these are all war films again.
Yeah, true. Anyway, I guess I find this interesting and something I wasn't expecting to come across in going through these disaster films is that the height of the disaster, this sort of peak of disaster films, is really just a 5-year stretch. It's just the first half of the decade. There's some residue and stuff that, keeps coming out, but still the heyday, I think, sort of ends here.
I think there are two, this is me again, like this is what we do on this show, by the way. Like, we kind of hallucinate these things because we have absolutely no hard knowledge on this. This is kind of just like we're making stuff up, right? Like, this is just a fun conversation of us just imagining this, right? Based on hearsay, logic, and some factoids from here and there, right?
Yeah. The odd nugget from Wikipedia.
Yeah. But that's kind of what makes it fun. So, take it with a grain of salt, dear listener. Like, don't go and quote this as gospel, because it's your own funeral, okay? But anyway, I think you're right. Like, this is like the first half of the decade, that's the stretch where this kind of just lives and dies. And everything after that, it's almost like, oh, they haven't figured it out yet that this doesn't work anymore, right? And I think the reason behind this may be that, like, we talked about this, about the potential target audience for these films, and the target audience for the disaster film is not the same audience who goes to watch Bonnie and Clyde, and who goes to watch Straw Dogs or The Getaway or that kind of movies. Like, this is not for the same people. This is for the sort of the 40 to 60, people who just, let me just go to the cinema and watch that Burt Lancaster picture. Let's see what Gregory Peck is up to. You know, that's kind of like, because I really like Roman Holiday. You know, let's see what he's up to. Oh, Michael Caine is in it. You know, like that kind of stuff, right? O.J. Simpson, who's that? You know, Paul Newman. So in this stretch, you have, as you said, like the new Hollywood is kind of slowly coming in the background. So if you look at the sort of the net of interest, if there's an interest in these films, so there's the sort of you don't see the new Hollywood coming because these disaster films, they make a shit ton of money, way more than everything else, right? So you don't see the trend rising, and you can only start seeing it as it starts eclipsing it, the disaster film. And I think this is a point when also the older audiences kind of clue in more, like on average, I suppose, with like older people would still go and watch The Godfather, right? Because everyone went and watched it, right? But I think overall, more people, like if you look at the sort of this cross section of the demographic by age, more the sort of the older demographic that would look at these disaster films, saying like these are the movies for me. They start seeing like maybe there's something interesting in these in what these youngsters are doing, you know, because this Jaws movie seems to be great, and they all go and watch it and makes a lot of money. This Rocky film's great. This you know, All the President's Men's great, and everything like that is great. And then they start and they get acquainted with this aesthetic, the 70s gritty aesthetic of, let's just say, more brutal realism as opposed to escapist of the 60s, big sets and spectacles and, you know, like model airplanes flying into clouds of dry ice. Okay. And they just move on, as in like the older audiences who would watch the disaster films, they decide, oh, we like this now better than we used to like this. This is fun. We get it. And also these movies are no longer as venomous as Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate or Easy Rider, where it's just like, it's alienating because it's about these hippies and why do I need to watch Dennis Hopper's penis? I'm not sure if he shows his penis in Easy Rider. But don't quote me on this. But yeah, but the point is that I think the target demographic for these movies just moves on. And I think the Hindenburg, not so much, I don't think it kills the disaster film. It's kind of just like the sort of awkward one last person clapping. You know, in a chorus of applause, there's this one idiot who just like, everyone stops clapping and he's still just at it.
Nice, well said, yeah. So,
and you're just like, oh shit.
Yeah, like, what?
Like, you know, like when there's a chant and everyone goes like, we want more. And then it just makes so much sense when, like, it feels powerful. When, like, it's like 1,000 people go like, we want disaster movies, we want. And all of a sudden, like, everyone just stops. And there's this one George Cisco like, we want this. Oh, shit.
I'm now alone. Yeah.
Awkward. Yeah. And then in the meantime, there's also Roger Corman in the background just like, hey! Because he's just like, it's my turn now. Everyone moved on. Now it's my turn to embrace this movie. This genre, keep it alive, right? But that's kind of how I would see it. Like, it's not I don't think the Hindenburg kills it, although it's not doing itself any favors because you still have to just follow a murder mystery where you have to somehow find an SS officer whose job is to find out who's the traitor on the ship, a likable lead. But I think that like on the business side of things, if you zoom out, I think it's not the Hindenburg that kills the genre, is that the genre fizzles out almost on its own, like as a measure of its own inertia, and the demographic that would enjoy it just moves on to movies that are just accessible to more people, because the like Taxi Driver is just accessible to more people. It's edgy and gross. But it's something that more people would just find something in it. Jaws is just for everyone.
Yeah, I was going to say, like,
if Rocky is for everyone.
More so than Taxi Driver, even. I can see someone who liked Burt Lancaster in the 60s and loved him in Airport. That's an easy jump to jump over to
Roy Scheider and Jaws.
Roy Scheider, 100%. Exactly. It's an easier jump over, even though it's got the 70s aesthetic. It's an easier jump over to Sylvester Stallone, you know, mm-hmm. living in sort of poverty in Philadelphia.
It's easier jumped into, you know, what's his face in Phantom of the Paradise?
Yeah. So, yeah. So anyway, this is something that I find sort of interesting, like the business side of it. But I think that's what's happening. And I think by the time, like, Rocky might be the one, because that was sort of a huge, huge, huge hit. That, you know, it sort of makes sense that, you know, now it's not just about the stable of writers that we have. If you're a studio, well, like, we should get rid of the stable of writers. Maybe they can get jobs with television, because a lot of television is formulaic and stays that way for a while yet. I think it's going to be more important to, you know, invest in, you know, filmmakers with a vision, like auteurs, and not just try to repackage your own Westerns and repackage stuff. You know, we need some guidance here. In a way, maybe it's the studio system saying, like, goodness, we need guidance, because we did Westerns and war movies for years and no one wants those anymore. No one wants musicals anymore. So we need some guidance. So, you know, these graduates from USC come along, Milius and Spielberg and Lucas and company, and show the way. And then we get into the conversations that we had last year about the 1980s, where the studios come back with a force and say, okay, cool, we see what you're doing now, that works. We got it. We got it from here.
Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I think
we'll do terms of endearment our way.
But I think what happens is, like, in the early 70s, all these guys are still are doing stuff, like, and they're doing kind of edgy things. Like, American Graffiti is kind of like a, mm-hmm. let's just say, like an outsider film. Like, John Milius is doing, like, Big Wednesday, and they're all kind of indie films. And then after it takes a while for these studios, because they move, they're these big, I don't want to say immovable, they're these big, big, slow-moving objects. Yes, they're also, yeah. They're like these icebergs, and, you know, like, the big container ships that they take a while to execute a maneuver, right? So it takes them a while to figure out, okay, well, these guys actually know what they're doing, you know, as in, like, it takes what Duel and Sugarland Express, and all of a sudden, like, look, this, you know, maybe, what happens if we give these people some money? What will mm-hmm. they do then? And all of a sudden, like, oh, we start hitting it big, people like it, and all of a sudden it gets seen. And you make a few of these strategic decisions, and all of a sudden, like, studios are again in their known territory, because they know, like, oh, we have our new template, we have something to latch on to, let's do more of this. Mm-hmm. So you have your creature features, you have your underdog stories, you have this sort of, like, the docudrama, sort of, like, this sort of, the gritty Avildsen style kind of just clings on for a while, and then you have the science fiction. Because all it takes is for little guy George Lucas to make his home movie under the patronage of Fox, and all of a sudden, like, okay, well, now we know what we're doing, because we've made a shit ton of money, and we can because what studios are good at is industrializing stuff. Mm-hmm. That's how they did with their sort of, like, impromptu hit with the airport, right, film?
Exactly, yeah. Where
they've just not, okay, well, this worked. What we're good at is doing more of the same.
I think you're 100%. And I even had a note here, like, how does this stack up to other disaster films? And just my own little answer, supporting characters. Like, it's following the template of Airport as mm-hmm. best it can, you know, even though you're trying to be a historical drama.
Clapping.
I need supporting characters that are sort of quirky, you know? So, yeah, like well said, Jakob. I think you nailed it. Like, that's exactly, now that they get the new template from the mid 70s on, then by the time we're in the 1980, okay, we can do that. We got it from here.
Yeah. Now, what they don't know is, usually at these sort of transition points, like, there's always this sort of, like, the few years, right, where there's this sort of for interface, sure, of, like, we don't quite know where we are yet, right? Mm-hmm. Some eras will be probably more easier than others. But I think, like, in late 60s, early 70s, this is kind of like the weird era, because you have all this edgy shit coming out, and they don't quite trust it yet. So you have this sort of these two worlds overlapping and kind of coexisting weirdly, right? Like, the sandal epic's not cutting the mustard. The Western's out of out of vogue, but equally they're not ready to go and just gives Sam Peckinpah like a vote of confidence and say like, do Wild Bunch, but more, you know?
Exactly.
Or just say, let's look at the Wild Bunch and say like, this is how we need to do Westerns. They don't quite know it yet,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then in the 70s, and like later in the 70s, they'll just say, okay, well, this is how, okay, now this is what we need to do. Space opera and science fiction is where it's at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then later on, it's just, like, oh, ensemble comedy, SNL, this is where it's at, you know? Or how action film evolves into action stars. Oh, this is what we're doing. And we're doing this all the way into the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the template sort of in here, right? This is something that they execute almost to the letter. If you look at like the Towering Inferno, like we have instead of Paul Newman or Burt Lancaster or Rock Hudson, what we have is George Colombo Scott, and instead of Karen Black, we have Anne Bancroft, right? Or instead of Gene Seberg, we have Anne Bancroft. Instead of
Helen Hayes as a quirky old woman, you have Burgess Meredith, the scammer, like the
exactly
shark.
yeah
exactly, yeah,
makes sense to me. So they execute a template, and also they add stuff that they think people like at the time, which is in Airport was, oh, people liked them Hitchcock films, so let's just make it into a Hitchcock film. And it kind of looks like a Hitchcock film that Hitchcock would have passed on because it doesn't have the Hitchcock factor, right? It's kind of like an ersatz. And in here they do an Agatha Christie. This is a Columbo film.
It's the Columbo, yeah. Because one thing at least. Yeah, no, totally. And one thing, if they've learned from Airport, well, we have so many of the different subplots going on and they all have their own weight. You can't really tell what's going on in Airport. Spoiler for our discussion on Airport.
Oh, there's more in there.
Yep, there's way more. But that is a fundamental issue with that movie. It's all over the map. This, in a way, tightens that up a little bit because it's got the mystery. It's got the Agatha Christie, Jaume Coyet Serra mystery, we'll say. Because he did that two times for us last month to great impact.
Jimmy, two times. I got to get the papers. Get the papers.
Interesting story on what's that character?
Jimmy two times?
Is it Jimmy two times?
I think it's Jimmy or Johnny two times. I think it's Jimmy two times.
Shoot. What was it? Yeah, interesting story, and I can't even remember the... Jacob two times. Jacob.
Good fellas. It says Jimmy two times?
Jacob. Jacob Tutu and the Hooded and Fang. Is that you ever? Jacob Tutu meets the Hooded Fang. Is that what you're referring to?
No, and just in Goodfellas, it was like, oh, and here's Jimmy. We call him Jimmy two times because he always said shit twice. And I got to get the papers, get the papers.
Totally forgot that. I'm thinking of a kid's book, Jacob Tutu Meets the Hooded Fang. And anyway, I was going to, I'll still do it. In 1999 or 2000, the dinner theater I work with, the guy that runs that, he got this weird gig for, I think it was New Line Cinema was holding some sort of a industry thing here in Charlottetown. So one of their big movies on their TV slate, I think it was Jacob Tutu and the Hooded Fang. And in the movie, Gary Busey's in it and Mark McKinney, the Canadian comic actor from Kids in the Hall. So anyway, we were hired, myself and the guy that runs the dinner theater and this other guy, we went down to this show and we were given the costumes from the movie and we just sort of circulated through this little trade show as Jacob Tutu and the Hooded Fang. And I played the Mark McKinney character. So I had Mark McKinney's costume and my buddy had Gary Busey's costume. Anyway, none of that has anything to do with anything, but except you were talking about a character in Goodfellas, and I was clearly talking about a children's book and a children's movie. Anywho, moving on to what we're here to talk about.
Nazis.
Yeah.
It's kind of like The Eagle Has Landed. Have you seen The Eagle Has Landed?
I have not.
Is it Michael Caine? That's an Alistair MacLean adaptation.
I don't know it.
It's about this plot that Nazis would infiltrate into the UK and kill Churchill. That was the plot. And it was an actual plot that, that apparently happened, I think. But I'm not sure if this... the book is not historically accurate or anything like that, but I think they had a plan like this. And this book is... Like, it's such a weird experience because you're watching a war movie, World War II movie, where you're actively following a Nazi plot to infiltrate the UK and kill the Prime Minister from the perspective of Germans whom you don't root for because they're Nazis. So you just watch them in this sort of weird, perplexed state your conditioning suggests that you're supposed to care for the heroes because these are men on a mission, so you're supposed to care about the mission. It's like, you know, where Eagles Dare, right? Mm-hmm. Where you watch the Americans and the Brits going into Eagle's Nest and just kill Hitler's somebody or something, right? Meanwhile, it's like the opposite in here, where the gimmick is like you're still caring, but at some point, like, you just think, like, why am I rooting for the Nazis? Why am I not rooting for the guys who try to stop them? Because they're not painted as anti-heroes whom you don't care about. They actually look like they're normal people. They just wear these Nazi uniforms. It's just very odd. And I feel like you kind of have a similar situation in here where you have this sort of, you know.
Well, I think you totally do. And this is one of my questions, so I might as well jump to that one now. What impact does the Nazi angle play on this story? Do you think this... how do you think this story, or Nelson Giddings or Lincoln Levinson, do you think they have to jump through certain hoops in order for this film to get made?
I don't think so. I think, no? Like, I don't know. Because there are scenes in here that make no sense to me. As in, like, they're very insensitive in a way. Like, oh, you run this ship like a concentration camp. What? It's just... Or there's this Casablanca moment. Or, like, anti-Casablanca moment, I call it. Where the guy goes, like, I'm going to perform a song with some visual aids. Because this guy's going to do... some pantomime to go with it when they sing a song about racial purity and so on, and I don't know. And it kind of seems like it's supposed to offend the Germans, but it kind of only does in the last second. And I feel like, is this like a Casablanca moment where, you know, like they sing the Marseillaise in a bar just to spite the Germans?
I wondered even if it's a cabaret moment where they're using music in some sort of fashion to make a point. Now here, I think the point is that we have to downgrade our support for the Nazi movement and Nazi Germany. Like, and I think that's where the song comes in because of the pantomime, which is a ridiculous scene. And this performer is really, really cringeworthy. I forget his name, but it's really, really an awkward scene for me to watch. But I wonder if in part that's why it's in here, because it's ridiculing Nazism, it's ridiculing Hitler. And there are these sentiments throughout the film that, you know, the Nazi regime is bad, you know, like George C. Scott.
If you need reinforcing, if you need this belief reinforced, Nazi's bad.
Yeah, but it's definitely in here. Like, it's in George C. Scott's character, because he's talking about, oh, it wasn't like this in the good old days, and these new Nazis they're different and have different values. And, you know, he doesn't wear a uniform, he doesn't wear stripes, so he's not affiliated with the Nazis, even though, you know, he's working for the government. And I think there's a number of these efforts.
An Oberhauptsturmführer or something like this, right? Like, he's an SS or Gestapo.
Right, and he's actively in conflict with him. So, I think these here are intentionally put in. He's a good German. But I think these are intentionally in play in order to make this palatable for an American audience.
Yeah, I'd say so. Because if this guy was like a Gestapo officer who's just like, I'm just looking for the guy and I'm going to torture and interrogate everyone because this is what Gestapo does, then... Like, who do you root for? Like, you don't really want... Like, you actively want this this bomb not to be found so that it burns down and you go like, yeah, die Nazis, you know? And you kind of sort of do at the end anyway.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird messaging, you know, because it is a Nazi ship. I don't have any love for this ship on that basis. But at the same time, we're meant to follow all of these people who are coming over, and they're not all Germans, and they're all mostly good people from what we can see. But
they're good Germans.
They're good. They're good German folk. But also, too, there's this business with Atherton, Dickless himself. He's the guy who is apparently responsible for a resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Or part of a resistance, better said. And we keep getting this these little shots, which are really, really hard to follow. We get these little moments and scenes and shots from his girlfriend, who apparently is involved with the resistance. And the resistance is something that, you know, the Nazis certainly denied there was such a resistance. So, in fact, the Nazis back in 1937-38, they said there couldn't have been a bomb because there's no such thing as a resistance. So I think that's something that was latched onto by the screenwriters to say, well, you know, ha, Hitler, there was a resistance and we're going to tease it right here. So it's another, like, it just seems there's all these little things that are sort of pointing to a screw you to Hitler. But it's really awkward because at the same time, it's a German ship, it's a German captain, it's a German George C. Scott, you know, it's weird to get behind this movie,
mm-hmm,
in a way.
And also, none of the other characters are likable either. Like, some of these good people, as in like this countess who has some business and she doesn't like the Nazis, or these Americans who do just business in Germany, or these Jewish people who are trying to sort of get away from there. You don't necessarily care because you don't spend time with them. They're just objects because... And red herrings,
mm-hmm,
in a bomb mystery for George C. Scott that you don't care about anyway. It's a very odd experience because, and at the same time, it takes like 2 hours for this film to unfold, and only for the last 10 minutes to be a concoction of this sort of stock newsreel footage with reenactments of the radio coverage and the actual thing and some of the documentary footage and then some of the footage that kind of sort of looks like it. It's very odd, and I feel like the big gamble is that I'm supposed to care about this. I care more about Kate Winslet and Leo DiCaprio in Titanic because at least they're not Nazis.
Well, and there's a maturity in the script, I guess. Like, even if you have complaints with Titanic, there's something that I can hang my hat on and follow through the first hour and a half of that.
Like a love story, right? Something simple.
It's something simple. It might not be the greatest in the world, but there's something that I can follow. And even then, the tragedy unfolds. Maybe it would be different if this tragedy unfolded over an hour and a half, but this tragedy unfolds. It's the nature of, you know, the combustibility of hydrogen, I suppose, that this tragedy unfolds in like a 5-minute finale. Mm-hmm.
But no, the tragedy unfolds in 2 hours. It's just, it pays off in 5 minutes, but it's kind of like my mnemonic for this was kind of like the steamroller scene from Austin Powers again, where it's just for 2 hours, you just see like, because we're slowly approaching the climax, mm-hmm, ever so slowly, until it becomes ridiculous. Where you just, oh, there's a set piece, there's a like a iceberg that they're supposed that we're losing altitude so slowly, so slowly, because they're just, I don't know, they, because William Atherton just like pokes a hole somewhere with his knife because he drops it or something. It's so odd.
It's very odd. So there's a scene here on the rear wing on the Zeppelin where it's Atherton who has to climb out and he lies down on the wing and sews a repair. I will give credit to this film because I can't think of a more suspenseful and vivacious sewing scene with such high stakes.
Like... Just by comparison,
there's that
against the background noise, it looks like the sort of the signal to noise of like, wow, the excitement versus the bass level is great because the amplitude is great. However, if you see like this peak of like, oh, here's the sort of the bass level of Hindenburg, and then this peak comes in, oh, that's the set piece. But if you overlay it against, I don't know, Die Hard, then it's even this peak of excitement looks like just background noise because it's just so tiny.
Like, yeah, nothing and I
happens
agree
in this film until everything happens. And when everything and what happens in the everything happens scene is something that you kind of sort of know about. So it's just the novelty of seeing it reenacted partially.
So what do you think of Robert Wise as a director? You've got a few of his films under your belt, and what do you think of his work here?
Like, I see what he's doing here. I like the idea of, you know, like, in principle, I like the idea of trying to kind of mesh this. I think this is kind of novel, right? Let's just use the Hindenburg footage from the 1930s, right? And let's just try and make... He had, a great idea for a scene. Mm-hmm. Let's just reenact this and then mesh the two together and see where the reality begins and illusion ends and vice versa. And I think he has a knack or an interest in finding reality or realism in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, the story doesn't lend itself very well for the most of its duration to that.
Yeah. Robert Wise is a guy that... I sort of like, I admire him. I think that he shows that he has an interest in whatever's popular or what's going on. And then he takes a crack at it and does a darn good job. Mm-hmm. But his films tend to pale in comparison to maybe what he's aping. So I'll use the example of Audrey Rose. I sort of liked Audrey Rose, but you know, it's nothing in comparison to The Exorcist, which I think is the clear influence for it, you know. And I would say something like the Andromeda Strain, I think his inspiration lies largely in 2001 and some of the work of Kubrick. Mm-hmm. So he's a solid filmmaker. I love his inspirations. He does a great job, but what he's Xeroxing are so impressive that he's just not going to look good in comparison. So here I think that he's seeing what's popular in the marketplace is, oh, these disaster films, they're taking off. I know what I can do on that. I can do the Hindenburg. I can bring a realism to the story of the Hindenburg. And I think he does an admirable job insofar as, yes, it's following the model of the disaster film, but he is also putting an interesting and impressive level of detail into this. I really do like the art department with all the matte paintings and the set designs and just the reconstruction of the interior of the Hindenburg. That it's sort of fascinating, and there's a lot of great shots, and you know, seeing all the, you know, the catwalks and the lattice work and the inside the body of the blimp. I think it's fascinating. Like the film looks pretty good. And I think that's where his strengths lie. But, you know, the problem here, and I think you sort of summed it up nicely, is everyone knows how this film is going to end. And lessons learned from Airport is you have to have some sort of a script to get us there, something mm-hmm. that's not all over the map. And with Lincoln Levin and Nelson Gidding, they focus on Agatha Christie, also popular at the time. So we get this murder mystery, but it's just... It's confusing. It just doesn't work. Like this whole mm-hmm. 140 minutes or whatever it is of this mystery. Who cares? I don't understand what's going on when we see Atherton's girlfriend back in Frankfurt. Make, you know, who's that? I forgot who it was.
Like making phone calls or something.
Yeah, I have no idea. So nothing really works. Nothing really makes sense. You know, none of the supporting characters are meaningful in any type of way. Although I see why they're there, because that's just part of the cookie cutter that comes from, you know, Airport mm-hmm. and Poseidon Adventure. So I do like Wise, but I think this is a miss, not because of his, you know, grandiose intentions. I think that it's just, there's just a number of things that are working against it. And, you know, one thing is the runtime, and then just the fact that the murder mystery along the way doesn't work. because the murder mystery also has to follow some of the truths and the realities that came out of his research. You know, because I'm using these characters have to work this way, and there could be someone on board that could be part of a resistance. The resistance was a thing. So, you know, and something I will say, because I remember last year I was sort of on a bit of a Hindenburg kick when I was watching this last year, and I watched a documentary on the Hindenburg, and there were three main, I believe there were three main theories as to why the Hindenburg exploded. And one of them was sabotage, one of them was St. Elmo's fire, and one of them was a spark from a leak through one of the main main hydrogen bags. And then wherever the spark came from, don't know. But at any rate, there was no real main leading theory for decades and decades and decades until I think the 90s, where I think for the most part now, they say it was a spark that happened to be nearby this leak, and that's what led to the explosion.
But is that the current knowledge?
That's based on sort of current knowledge, I think, okay, since the 90s or early 2000s. Because there were these dudes that made these, I think they were 1/6 scale replicas. They did experiments, and they tried to simulate an explosion as if it were sabotage. They tried to simulate St. Elmo's fire on it, and they, by charging it, and then they tried to simulate a leak in one of the gas bags. So the sabotage, that explosion looked really, really, really close to the actual recorded footage of the explosion. So the folks that did this documentary, they sort of, maybe it was sabotage because a bomb would make the explosion look that way. Mm-hmm. But so too did the spark, like the spark next to the leak. So, but in any rate, for a long time, like sabotage was a leading theory. And I think that's why Wise probably said, okay, well, we can go ahead with this story because that's one of the leading theories. No one knows. So that's sort of viable enough. And, you know, that creates the intrigue to give us a 2-hour skeleton of a script, mm-hmm, right, with rising action and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's an Agatha Christie thing where the pieces don't really work.
Yep.
You know, the red herrings aren't really that red or herring. So they're anyway,
not very herring. I will just say this. It's not necessarily because, like, one of the sort of theories was that, you know, like, okay, well, maybe just people got tired and moved on. I think it's just a byproduct because it, as in, like, this is just what happened. Like, people moved on, and this movie was kind of called out clapping when everyone stopped. And at the same time, if this film happens in 1972, as in, like, if it's greenlit and produced immediately after Airport gets off the ground, again, weird sentence, immediately after Airport makes 100 mil, and this gets greenlit, and it gets released in 1972 in the summer, right? Mm-hmm. It still doesn't win because it has the same problem. As in, it's an Agatha Christie scenario where you don't know who to root for because you have to assume that one of these Nazis is kind of a good guy. And all I have to go by is what he says to me. Like, you don't see him be a good guy. You see him like, oh, I lost my son in the war. And so he has this sort of internal pain. But all I get is what he tells me. How do I know if he's telling me the truth? I don't know. So I don't see him be good. I can be a good guy. I just see people tell me that he is one. And that never helps. That never works anywhere near as good.
Mm-hmm.
A seeing, right?
Yeah, it's a film that relies on George C. Scott's star power, right? Like, we follow him, and he's the star, and he's the good guy. So to me, in a way, like, they had to be very delicate with how they treated all the Nazi stuff. And it's just too much baggage to make the Agatha Christie stuff work, because we sort of saw it work to a point with something like Nonstop, because it, you know, it serves its purpose and gets us to the end. But here, but it's...
Liam Neeson's not a Nazi, though.
That's what I mean. Like, the baggage of this, the backstory and the actual history here, the baggage is a bit much for this film.
Mm-hmm.
To bear. So
yeah,
agreed. What do you think of the ending?
Oh,
get into that. This is noteworthy.
That's kind of like one of, like, I want to say this is kind of the last thing I think I have to say about this film. This movie perks up in the last 10 minutes. I mean, agreed, like the explosion moment is kind of a bit wild because you kind of see like George C. Scott's weird silhouette for a second when the thing blows up. And from then on, it's like 10 minutes of horror. And I think like I've waited for this for nearly 2 hours because this is where this movie actually just like takes a breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it works because everything you can see. That's the kind of filmmaking kind of that I like. As in, like, this is the 70s filmmaking. I think Robert Wise is kind of one of those guys who kind of embraced these ideas a little bit more, or maybe even accidentally, because they accidentally just burned down their set. So I don't know how much of that you can see, but the idea was that he actually set shit on fire. And I think the notion of interspersing actual historical newsreel footage or documentary footage that people captured, because it was a big deal, this thing, the biggest blimp in the world or something. So people were just, there were cameras pointed at this thing when this happened. So there's footage of it burning down. Makes an interesting experience, I think. Problem is, it's over immediately and we're kind of just like, okay. So it's a little bit too little too late almost, because mm-hmm. like I just ended, like, kind of, it's kind of like, I don't want to quote from my own little Letterboxd review, which is like two sentences, but it's kind of like, well, the climax comes and it's great, but with the expense of having spent almost 2 hours waiting for it, it feels unfulfilling in a way, but in the moment, mm-hmm. I really enjoy this, sort of like the flying bits of debris, everything's on fire, these people are jumping out, and I know there's some things are faked because, you know, they're not jumping from a height, so it's a bit, oh, you know, there's magic tricks in here, but it cooks. That scene is worth the entirety of my rating that I'm gonna share is exactly on the back of this scene, and that's all it is. The rest of this film could just go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, and I like the fusion of the actual news footage into the mm-hmm. The actual drama and the stunts and everything that Robert Wise is creating. It does make me wonder, you know, would this be a little bit cooler if the whole thing were black and white? Because of the narrative problems, probably not. But it would be interesting, and it might have helped even a little bit, because I really do like that it does, the film does go to black and white. That's a choice that Wise makes, and I think it really works. I think it's interesting to show the simulation of this carnage next to the real deal. And I think it's old enough of footage, because when this was made, what was it, 38 years old, 37 years old, this mm-hmm. tragedy, something like that. So, you know, it certainly evades the conversation in my mind. Oh, it's too soon. It's insensitive. I think that it's long enough past that I don't think
38 years is too soon. No, it's not. Yeah. Like, we had 9/11 films like almost immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, like to me, this, I agree with you. I think that this is the best stuff in the film, you know, easily, because it is exciting. It's something that I haven't really seen before. It made me wonder, actually, if James Cameron really appreciated the strengths and weaknesses of this film, so that he made choices when he was doing Titanic that, you know what? I understand fully how the Hindenburg could work, the film, and how it could fail and what its problems are, because it, you know, it does come up short, and it lies in the narrative. So I'm going to have a narrative that sort of works on its own. People can piss on me all they like, but when I get to the carnage bit, and that's probably the stuff I care about the most, people won't be yawning. People won't be annoyed because they followed the narrative along, and the narrative sort of works on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, the Cameron gets a lot of heat for having very basic stories, but in some ways they're sort of a saving grace, because they're the skeleton that a lot of these films that we've been talking about that don't have. So I wonder if Cameron, whether he thoughtfully thought about the Hindenburg or not, I don't know. But I could see him knowing this film quite well and knowing what he was going to do to avoid its problems.
I mean, if James Cameron ever decided at some point in the past, because he's not going to do this now, to make the Hindenburg remake, this would have been kind of like a dry run for Titanic. Because we talked about this on the Abyss episode last December. Or December before last, I suppose. Where he gets by, he wins on the back of these simple constructs, narrative constructs, that I think he makes them thrive on the fact that he just wears his earnestness on his sleeve, that they're just so simple and so archetypal that you just get on with it. You don't just think, like, you don't dismiss them as cliche, you just accept them as cliche because life's cliche. So there's just simple relationship. This guy tries to get, I don't know, win his wife back, right? That's kind of the stuff you have. Or in Titanic, you have these two people falling in love, and then and the fact that there's this woman is kind of either married or betrothed to a guy who's an asshole. That's it. That's the film. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to kind of navigate this simple human relationship drama, right? And in a way, you could think, okay, this could work. And I think, I mean, maybe Titanic has also another leg up in that there's no footage of it sinking, so you get to imagine stuff.
Well, and also the disaster takes place over the course of 2 hours.
Yeah, and this thing goes like va va voom, and then we're gone.
This is done in 2 minutes.
This could be retitled as Gone in 60 Seconds, but, you know.
It's true. Yeah. Like, it's...
Yeah. But, yeah, but I see your point. I'll probably say, like, on some level, I'd probably say, like, well, there was a time between 1989 and 1997 for this movie to be remade by James Cameron, and would have probably been great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still... I don't know if I can see it. Right, so I can see maybe a spectacular ending, something that Cameron's touches would do, but I'm wondering what the film is that leads up to that, and then plus it's still got the additional baggage of how do you do the Nazi story. So, you know, it's complicated to make this work anyway.
I mean, because we don't know how Titanic sank. And we know how Hindenburg burned, as in, like, this is what it looked like. We don't necessarily care how it got to that point, but what you could then make it, like, this is me making a better movie than the Hindenburg. Instead of George C. Scott being a Nazi detective, make him a Nazi defector that he really needs to get out of Germany, right? And he's this good guy who's trying to evade the forces, and then there are people on the ship on his tail, and all he needs to do is land and surrender himself or something, and he's going to be safe. And he won't, because this shit's going to burn down, and that's part of the tragedy. But then again, maybe he will, you don't know. Maybe he's going to jump off, and like some people survive, right? And then all of a sudden, like, make it about a simple character trying to accomplish something would have probably made a difference to me, because I wouldn't have to care about the fact that I'm following a Nazi plot. I'm caring about the fact that someone's trying to evade the Nazis, right? Or, I don't know, a Jewish scientist. Something, right? I don't know. Smuggling plants of the Death Star or something. You know, like that kind of shit. Like, you can make it up. I don't care. But, you know, like, it makes it, I don't know, relatable and followable.
Right. I hear you. I think this is the exact thing that throws up in the face of Wise's research. So, like, because I think that's sort of a big thing, is he wants to be honest. He wants to tell the story. He's done all this research, and there's sort of a margin of I don't know in the idea of there being a resistance, because one of the active theories in the 70s, at least, was maybe it was sabotage. So, I don't know. But also, too, you have the problem of, regardless, it's still a 10-minute ending. And you're going to have to come up with a narrative that makes, you know, 100 minutes of sense to get to the 10-minute ending.
I know. I think I'd be fine with a narrative where I follow a character and actually root for him to survive this.
Yeah.
Because I don't care if any of these people survive. That's the problem. Like, what do I care about? Did he find the bomb? I know if there is a bomb, I know he doesn't find it because this shit blows up. So all I care about would be the Hitchcocking suspense, as in, like, is he going to make it out in time before this thing burns down completely? Or am I watching a doomed endeavor? In which case, it's a different kind of experience, because I'm watching essentially a new United 93 experience where I know all these people are going to die. Mm-hmm. And I get to wrestle with this. So if I'm watching someone who's going to die, let it be someone that I care about.
Yeah, fair enough.
And here, like, there, none of these people are kind of worth the time of day. So that's kind of like the biggest issue for this. Like, we've danced around this.
That's Wise's research, right? Because I think all of these characters represent people who were on the Hindenburg.
Because he has the manifesto, right? So he knows. Okay, well, these are the CVs of all these people.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. So this one was a countess. This one was like, I don't know, some kind of a businessman. And there are these little dramas, like this guy's taking the Zeppelin to beat a guy who takes the Queen Mary to New York to close a business deal. Like, mm-hmm. What? Like, you know, like, fuck the Nazis. Like, just make a movie about this guy trying to make it in time to close the business deal.
Yeah.
It would probably be more important. And don't make it 2 hours. Like, 80 minutes is fine.
That's a huge issue, actually, is the runtime. What was the runtime?
I think it's over 2 hours.
I was going to say, it felt like over 2 hours. Must have been. But yeah, this could have been a tight 90, 100 minutes.
Yeah, way better. Like, shave off 25 minutes, immediately improving, I think. The odds of me liking it, because as it stands, it's kind of hard.
All right, I don't have anything else. I don't think George C. Scott didn't do anything. I think
we've milked it for enough.
I think so. And even George C. Scott himself, I don't think he does anything too worthy to discuss, unless you had anything to say about him.
He's actively telling us to turn it off.
All right, let's jump into our final thoughts, Jakob.
Yeah, I don't think I've changed my mind much. I think this is, I think if anything, I've come up with a better movie in the process.
Maybe.
It's 2 stars for me on the back of the ending alone. And the fact that George C. Scott's in shape. And that's good to see. So I'll put it that way. 2 stars for me. It's a boring film with a very satisfying ending that comes too little too late to salvage and rescue the film. That's kind of where I'm going to leave it. Too long, too boring, too little too late to come with the action and excitement and actually innovative type of filmmaking that really makes a difference. But yeah.
So yeah, last year when I watched this, because of the Robert Wise kick that I was on, you know, I saw 3 stars in this. This time, it's coming down. It's going to be a 2.5-star affair. Is it an uncut gem? Last year, I would have said, yeah, probably, because I really do like the look of this film. I like the efforts that go into the mats and the infrastructure of the Zeppelin on the inside, and it looks pretty good. But yeah, it's unescapable that it's slow, and the Agatha Christie thing doesn't really work. And then just as we're talking about it, I think that Wise's commitment to making this as realistic as possible and true to the events and true to the people who were on the ship as possible, I think that creates these problems where there's no real drama connected to it, at least during the overseas portion of the film. Like, but yeah, the film does come alive in the last 10 minutes or so, whatever it is. This is really breathtaking work. I think Wise is a very interesting director, and he's got a great visual flair. I think that the ending looks, I like the choice to switch things over to black and white and make it line up as best as possible with the newsreel footage that was available from the time. That looks really good. But yeah, this probably isn't an uncut gem. This is an interesting marker as it comes in 1975. And I think now you're getting into the really big hits from New Hollywood. So all of the disaster films that follow this one, they're just little footnotes. I don't think there are any big ones after this, because the movie public has moved on and they see what, you know, New Hollywood has to offer, and it's cooler. So anyway, that's me. All right. Tops.
Oh,
what are your top three moments, or however many?
Right. I've got I don't have too many. What I have is, some of these belong on a bottom list, so I don't have to decide. I like the conversation about Guernica. Like, they have this sort of conversation about, you know, how Nazis just sent planes to bomb a Spanish city. Just because, or a village. Like, 3,000 bombs or something. Oh, Jesus. I'm gonna do this on the top list. The last moment of the film when they list people who survived and who died, and the last person listed is a dog.
Yeah. I could mention, yeah.
The Dalmatian survived. I laughed my ass off. I'm just like, actually, you know, I'm going to put it on the top list.
And that's true. Like, there were two dogs on the Hindenburg. They did not survive, though.
Yeah, but this one survived. I'm like, okay. And the best one is just the ending. I'm gonna use this as the ending. Really like the set piece. The Hindenburg burning set piece is great. So I'm gonna leave it there. Special mention for that blast moment where they just really inventively just use a silhouette. It kind of looks very very psychedelic
for very a second. Vertigo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the final sequence with the guy from the radio was like, I can't believe what I'm seeing.
Yeah,
when you actually have it interspersed with the actual voice of the guy, it is phenomenal. This moment, it's the last 5-10 minutes of this film. Like, you might as well just like skip this film and watch from 110 minutes until the end. It's great. That's kind of where I am.
Perfect. Okay. For me, I really like number three. I really like the matte painting backgrounds. I find the interior of the Hindenburg. So the Hindenburg I've been aware of my whole life, basically. My sister was like born. My sister was born on the same day as that tragedy, May 6th. So my birthday, the tragedy, was Kennedy being shot. My sister's birthday, she was born on the date the Hindenburg exploded. So I always sort of had this tragedy in mind, just sort of from the annals of history. So, so to see the inside of it and to see that, you know, there were several suites and rooms, like not like a hotel, but more like a cruise ship or something, to see the layout of the inside, I found that fascinating. But as part of that, to see the, you know, the wire work and the lattice infrastructure and the metal, I just found a lot of the interior shots where there's these catwalks between the hydrogen bags. I found that fascinating. And then there's some good matte painting drawings too of the sky and whatnot. So that was good. Number two, the best sewing suspense scene in film history, possibly. Atherton is on the small rear wing of the airship, and he's madly sewing stitch by stitch. Come on, man, we got to get you in here. Just a second. Yeah. So, you know, kudos for that. Like you say, it's it's a blip that, you know, if you if you line the graph of excitement of this film next to many other action films, you know, you wouldn't even notice it. But in this film, you know, you notice Dickless on the side of the ship sewing like a madman. So I'll give credit for that. And number one, same, like there's the ending of the film. Dickless on the side of the ship. If anyone out there has just started listening to us and aren't familiar with Ghostbusters, so when Bill Murray calls a guy dickless, yes, it's true, this man is no dick. This is the same actor. That's why I've referred to him this way, and he's a good actor.
The tragedy is that people refer to him as dickless.
I know, and I'm not helping. I'm so sorry, Mr. Atherton.
Perpetuating a very hurtful stereotype of this man. Okay,
it's true, but he is pretty good in here. Like he's you know, it's a good performance. Said, so.
But he doesn't have a dick.
So
he really doesn't have a dick.
Anyway, so there's that. My number one is, as you said, like the last 10 minutes of this are absolutely phenomenal. I like the choice to go to black and white. I like the choice to include the actual newsreel footage interspersed with actual footage. Robert Wise he's a great director. Like he's got a visual touch, and it all comes together in the end. And this, it's a really, really, really well shot moment, and it's an extended sequence in a way too. Like it's like 10 minutes of or so of this, so it's hard to sort of cut out a little moment to isolate. So yeah, again, same as you, the whole final 10 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. Okay, now bottoms.
Right, I've got one that's funny. When the SS asks a guy for papers, and the guy gives the guy a newspaper, and I'm just in like, these people you don't joke around with. Like this is how you get in prison. But I have these moments like, guy finds a pistol and pulls the trigger, as in just to test it. Like, and he's in a blimp, so he just finds it. Oh, pistol, and just presses the trigger. I'm just like, what if it was loaded? He just like pokes a hole through the thing. All of a sudden there's a gunshot on the blimp. So that's one.
Excuse me.
I've got a guy killing time with an accordion. I don't know if this is just such a bizarre.
Didn't even catch that. Where was that?
Such a bizarre moment. Because he goes and visits, I think this is like the ship designer or something. And he has this little suite. And he just sits there playing an accordion just for himself.
as one does.
As you do. And I've got the shittiest clairvoyant ever. Oh, I'm a clairvoyant. And she's just like, I'm predicting the Duke of Windsor, and that isn't that going to relinquish the throne and just marry that woman, Simpson woman? And something about Betty Davis.
Nice.
It's just such a stupid moment. I mean, okay, fair enough. There's a pedantic prick somewhere on the ship. We're 4,000 miles to go. And it goes like, no, it's 4,100 miles to go. I'm just thinking like, prick.
Yeah.
What difference does it make? What? 0.15% difference. Indistinguishable, you idiot.
Except going that speed, you'll feel it.
You'll feel every mile. This is what, you know, this is what the adverts would be. Come over on a trip to America on a Zeppelin, a Hindenburg Zeppelin. You will feel every mile.
Feel every kilometer. Yeah. Oh, God. Okay.
And hear it, too. Just... Because if the engine stops, this thing will just drift into something.
Yeah.
Chances are it's going to blow up, too, because it's like, well, what if we run into some kind of weather? It's not like we can just go into the stratosphere because it's going to be really cold and not very breathable. So we have to just fly through storm clouds. And this is when it goes like, bang!
Done. Yeah, so you don't have a nice, comfortable place like New Jersey to crash in.
Yeah, exactly. The beautiful field.
Okay,
just,
all right.
It's out of nowhere. It's just like, how many blimps have just disappeared because they go like... in the middle of the ocean.
Okay, that's you. Those are your bottoms.
Me. I'm done.
All right, I have a little complaint. So there's, what's our altitude? 350 meters. Rate of descent, 10 meters per second. Sorry, 10 meters per minute. That gives us 25 minutes. So without any other explanation, I would naturally think...
Bullshit.
That in 25 minutes, you're going to crash into, you know, the ground or the water. So according to my math, they should have 35 minutes because they didn't explain something special about the 100-meter threshold. 350 meters, 10 meters per second. It should be 35 meters per second. So that's just a little grumble that I have. Number two, the character Spa, the acrobat, Ben yep. Dova, who's the real gentleman's name, his interpretive dance mocking the Nazis is just ridiculously cringy. It's yep. abrasive humor. I don't care. That's great that he's making fun of the Nazis, and that's probably the point. But at the same time, this just reminds me of someone who likes attention. They're comfortable getting up on stage and they'll act a fool because they like attention, not because they have any craft at all. So I just thought that was a really awkward, abrasive, really uncomfortable moment to have to sit through. And I was like Charles Durning. He was offended and walked out. I should have too. And number one, I'm going to say Atherton's girlfriend and the story of the resistance. It's not a moment, who but cares? It's emblematic of the problem with the Agatha Christie side of this, you know, oh, the resistance is sort of this thing that's going on that I should follow. It's confusing and I don't want to follow because I'm not really that engaged with Atherton. I'm definitely not engaged with his girlfriend who's been arrested in Frankfurt. So that's my bottom of the bottom.
Oh, gross.
And that is it. The Hindenburg. You can rent it or buy it digitally in pretty much all over UK, US, Canada. I couldn't find it streaming anywhere in those major jurisdictions. It's available on Blu-ray. I do know that. It's on DVD. So you can go out and find it if you're so inclined. And, you know, if you want to, if you're a Robert Wise completionist, then I recommend it. But otherwise, you know, this is one that you can sit out, go get the Andromeda Strain. I can get behind that one again.
It's not
give that a try. Yeah. But anyway, Jakob, where can our friends find you?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at TalkAboutFilm, and you can find me on as Jakob Flash on Letterboxd and on flashonfilm.com, which is FLASZ on film.com, where I write stuff about stuff. Yeah, and also on medium.com, I sometimes write there, and which is something that's not film related. Weirdly enough, it's usually fitness related. I don't know why. But yeah, that's kind of what I do. Anyway. Cool.
And I'm going to say the last few months, you've been prolific. It just seems that I'm always getting these posts about some new piece that you've done. And they're all terrific, and I'm a few pieces behind. I still have to catch up. But yeah, everyone out there should check out some of Jakob's work. As for me, you can find my reviews on Letterboxd at Brad7. You can find me at my Facebook group, Island Film Geeks. You can find me on X. I don't really do a whole lot there, but you can find me there at Randy Burrows. You can find me on Jakob's site, flashonfilm.com. Actually, I have one article there. I have a couple things in the wings, nothing necessarily imminent, but I have a couple things in the wings. So I am looking to do more writing this year. I am working on a relatively big project that I don't want to say anything about because I'm going to jinx it, but that's in the works. You can find us in general, our podcast activities, at our website, www.uncutgemspodcast.com. All of our stuff is there, information on us. You got information on the main show and the Patreon. That's all enclosed in that online headquarters of ours. In 2 weeks, meet us back here because we're going to begin our monthly theme for March, which we've called Spring Clinging. And it's a series about overzealous fans. We'll just leave it at that mostly for now. Our connection from this episode, because that's what we're doing this year. We're connecting one theme into the next month's theme by way of a linking episode. So that's this. So the way that we are connecting our 70s air terror to spring clinging is via an epic east-to-west journey. So in 2 weeks, our spring clinging theme will begin with another east-to-west journey. I'll sort of save it as a secret what we're doing, but that's the connector. Next week, though, come on back, because the first Friday of every month all year, we're going to be talking about the films of Spike Lee. So here on the main show, we're discussing his minor joints. And next week, we will be discussing 1990s Mo' Better Blues. So see you here for that, and have a great week.